huge fan of Charles Bukowski. In fact, after last May, I had this Bukowski CD of his poetry readings that I was listening to while I was driving in France, and that's really part of my... So, and I've seen the Ben Gazzara film, and I've seen, of course, the Mickey Rourke Barfly. I've forgotten the name of the Ben Gazzara.
The
Tales of Ordinary Man?
Yeah, and then you have also this Cold Moon, the Ferrari film.
Can you help me with that? I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, it's Cold Moon, Lune Froide. It's Italian-French production.
How many years ago?
In the 80s, I think.
In the 80s?
Yeah. And you also have another one. It's Dominique Deruder, you know him? It's a Belgian filmmaker.
No.
He made one based on, I think, three separate short stories.
Okay.
I don't remember the name of that one.
Also the 80s, the 90s?
No, that's... Yeah, maybe 90s, end of 90s. It's not that old, actually.
Okay.
That's what I know about, and a few short films, of course.
Now, I think, like everybody else, I was really impressed, very pleasantly surprised how well Matt got it. But if I was, let's say, a run-of-the-mill producer, and you were talking to me about wanting to make this, I would say, well, I think that Matt Dillon's an interesting choice, but he's a little too young, a little too good-looking. And your response was, did you have that conversation with the
Absolutely,
producer?
And I mean, it's kind of obvious thought. Not the age, I would say, because in the book, he's struggling to get published, and so he's young. Yeah, he's younger in the book.
30.
But still, to find a guy in the 20s to do this, that would be very difficult, I would say.
Yeah.
So we thought that if he was in his 30s, we could still do it, and
right.
It's kind of believable.
Right.
I think with Matt, I mean, today you see his performance, but now we are talking before we start.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally agree. But I think my reference was, first I reacted like you because we got the suggestion through a friend of him. It's a friend of us also. And then I couldn't see Matt the last 12 years. Obviously he did good parts, but it's not my cup of tea at all, this romantic comedy. So my reference was the younger Matt. And I couldn't get the younger Matt out of my head. And looking back on Matt, the quality of his acting and behavior, I mean the vulnerability, the role vulnerability, his kind of being. We loved, and I mean all Europe loved it, and everybody's talking about, now they're talking about the new Matt because he's back again. But that gap, nobody knows films yet, and obviously this All About Mary, and I mean some other blockbusters, but still, people are talking about the old films, but now they start talking about the new films. So, had that in mind, and as you know, I'm coming from the, someone put so well, the melancholy vodka belt up north there. I thought by try to get back to the old Matt, using his kind of flirting potential, the womanizing, he has that, but you have to keep it down, keep his eyebrows down, and his comic talent as well, the timing. I mean, it's enough dark stuff to build it on, and I mean, that's also kind of different questions I get. His two hands on two dits and two that. First of all, he's not playing Bukowski, it's his alter ego, Henryk Chernowski, and I think whoever, you could find someone who looks even more down and out than Bukowski, but still, I think to make a film and try to make it truthful, it is an adaptation, it is a film, it's not a book, it's not a documentary, you have to forget him for a while and try to start from scratch and find the references in you. And I believed in Matt that he has all these kind of qualities if he was willing to take the risk. So it was more in the end to talk about, do we want to take this risk, do you want Matt? And he liked the script so much, and he wanted to do something else, and this was also at the same time he did Crash, and I think he was looking for other stuff. I think that was also the part of the beginning of the conversation with his friends. Matt is looking for something, he wants to do something new now.
Yeah, sure.
So all this together, I think all of us took a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Matt took the biggest risk, but that, I mean, whoever I choose and choose me, you couldn't say if it was right or wrong, but I was willing to take the risk, and we took it together with that kind of, what to say, understanding as a basis.
One of my most favorite lines that he has ever spoken was the line in Drugstore Cowboy, which was the line about how one of the reasons that junkies become junkies is because life is so difficult and hard, like waking up in the morning and having to tie your shoes, which is a
yeah. But now I'm getting older, I know what I'm talking about. Yeah, you don't have shoes to use.
Yeah. But I don't think you can watch this film without, I mean, those people that are going to be interested in either having read Bukowski, and I know that every younger generation gets into them just as much as the next. That's
yeah.
been happening at least since the 80s, if
yeah.
not the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
From what you know of it.
So, yeah, and you, whatever you want, you automatically refer to him. And that was also one of the challenges too. He's so visible, it's nearly impossible to get him out for a while.
Yeah.
But what we said, I think, was we talked a lot to Linda, like Linda Bukowski, and when it was difficult sometimes, it was nice to call Linda, and she believed much in Matt, actually.
Mm.
And she's quite strict, right. I mean. Mm-hmm. And Lily also, of course, she loved.
Right.
And then we were talking about, I mean, easy things like never white socks, never always two pants,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the things like that to establish his character. And after a while, I saw, like, Matt, it was a matter of belief that he could do it. I mean, to play a drunk, I mean, you can imagine, like, an actor, and you can't play a drunk, it's impossible. I think drunk people on screen is, I mean, if you're dealing with professionals like Bukowski, they are not waving from one side of the street to another. I mean, you have to get it in as an element, and a kind of natural element.
Mm-hmm.
Same as the writing, same as the way he's talking, his humor, his poetry, his understanding. And I think that was... So I think we approach very widely all the time, all of us, and try to do it, say, authentic in a way, and try to take away all acting, everything, and try to get to the bottom, and give it a chance, and take that risk. That was what we was discussing all the time. Try to get to the bottom, do it very transparent. And that's a big risk, of course, and as a producer, like you start asking, but will it fly? I mean, it's nothing to hook it on, it's no dramaturgy, it's just episodic. And I say, okay, but we have to lean on the scenes, what's there, is there, the characters, try to establish some humor, which I really feel connected to with the Bukowski, and I mean the humor also give him or show that he has a self view. For me, if it's a good humor, it's you can understand that people has a self view,
right.
And with the self view, it's also come a kind of background and depth to his understanding of life from his point of view.
Right.
And if you coming down to that point, I think it's more that connect us than separate us, even if we are living safe lives, at least most of the time. And but still, there is something that connect us, and you can feel related to. And that was my aim, I think, to show that, and the warmth between people living like that. So it's a love story as well between Matt and Lily, people in the same situation in a way, and trying to survive every day.
Now, I saw it, as I told you last May. When did you complete the film? When did it actually film?
The shooting?
Yeah.
We shot it in... when was it? 2004. And we completed the shooting in July 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And then it opened in Cannes in 2005.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm using a long time, but I don't do many films. So, and I took it to Norway to do all the poster.
Has it played commercially in Europe anywhere yet?
Yeah, yeah, many places.
Right.
And yeah, good critics. We hope for more audience, but it's very good critics. And it's for this kind of film, it's I mean, it's not a blockbuster, obviously. So I'm very curious about
America. If you care about the whole Bukowski legend, and if you've seen anything, you know anything about it, you have to go see this. I don't think anybody
No, I would at least.
I mean,
yeah, obviously. But that's what also pleased me. I mean, most people that really are into Bukowski, they like it. And I mean, if they don't like it, that's okay. I mean, but if you're going to see a film and a person that looks like Bukowski and all that, then you might be disappointed. But I mean, it's like you're doing a portrait. You have to do it through find the effect of it in a way. If you want to do it just exactly the same, you can take a picture. I mean, so for me, it's interpretation also, but the essence. And I mean, Linda was the first that called me. I was so nervous, and at least it gave me a lot. And she saw it, and she said she was so touched, and that was a strange feeling also. She was very touched. You recognize so much about Hank when she saw it. And for me, that was kind of hit that I really wanted to hit spot.
In which European countries, I mean, it's understood that Bukowski has a very strong following in the US, but is he more popular in, say, Germany than anywhere else? Did I hear that once?
Yeah, I think Germany and maybe France is quite big, but that's because, I mean, also in general, people are educated, they are into culture,
yeah.
And Norway also, I mean, people read him in Norway as well. But still, I mean, but it's a strange situation because he's an outsider but he's read by quite a lot of people anyway, so he's not an outsider either.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one leg in each kind of society, I would say.
Why are we hearing these huge percussion noises every 2-3 minutes? Are you hearing this?
Yeah.
It's like a bomb going off every time.
I don't know.
I mean, I'm listening to what you're saying, I'm getting it, but all of a sudden, boom!
Maybe it's a bomb.
Anyway, the film will be released what date again?
I don't know the date, but they told me maybe in August, I heard, but I have to ask them so I don't do anything wrong about that. I'm not sure, but I heard during the summertime, sometimes.
Do you know the double CD that I'm referring to, the one that I listened to?
Yeah, I didn't know it before. Matt bought it, and he listened a lot to it also.
Oh, wow.
But that was after, because we did a recording before I started the shooting with Matt in the studio. I had a script supervisor there, and tried to plan it, so how long time I needed for each scene to read it with the right pace. So,
hey Matt, how are you?
And just talking about, I think Matt.
Are we a joiner?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm soon finished. Isn't that right, Matt? He's asking me about the CD with the reading of Hank's work, and I think you was the first. I hadn't listened to it before, but you bought it in Minneapolis, I think, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, when I was getting into the character, you know, I got it in New York, and I started to listen.
Okay. Yeah. But you was the one that bought the CD.
Yeah. And then we found
on the net you also find something, I think, that you'd sent to me. Some old.
There was the written. This one's for the grocery clerks.
Oh, it's a
great poem.
It's fantastic.
Very moving poem.
Mm-hmm.
One of my most favorite poems of his on that CD, actually, he reads, is The Genius of the Crowd. You know that one?
Which one is that?
It's about people's capacity to loathe, despise, and do harm to anything that threatens their sense of normality.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could quote it for you, chapter.
His poems are so different than, you know, they're so beautiful. I mean, he would hate to hear the beautiful is like a word that's not in his dictionary, but, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that really helped me, that poem. This one's just as, I think the other one was great, Roll the Dice, too.
Yeah,
because these things really define who he was,
yeah.
You know. you know, the ones, this one's for the nuns. It's really, there's a lot of references to the work, all the work that he did as a worker, just a worker.
Yeah.
He was really a...
The interesting thing when you listen to him talk or do those readings on that is that there's such a great soothing, almost a, you know, lulling quality to his voice, and it's a very, very soothing, nice tone that has smoothness and authority, and yet it's quiet. And I just,
yeah, some softness, but he's so thin, his voice also. So you're getting quite surprised about that too.
That was from my standpoint of playing him. I think he was very shy. I mean, I picked up on that, you know, and watching some interviews with him and also from listening to that stuff. He did not like public reading. And so I think one of his, I think probably there's a little bit of a protective veneer that he had when he would do this affected voice. And for me, I was really concerned about, you know, I wanted to capture that, but, you know, I didn't want to seem like he, because it sounds like he's doing an impersonation of himself sometimes, you know. And so I, you know, in thinking about the voice, I thought, well, this is a combination Bukowski and who Chinaski was, who, when he created Chinaski, what Chinaski's voice, I don't think sounded like Bukowski's voice in a funny way, so...
But I think that's also, I told you about what Linda told me the first time she saw the film. I was scared to death about that telephone call, but she said, "Bent, I'm touched. I recognize so much of the soft side of Bukowski, which I haven't seen performed before." And that's a part of what you're saying also, and I was so proud that she said that. That was the first thing she told me.
Maybe it's
yours? I thought it was on vibrate. I don't think it's mine. Yeah, it's unbelievable. But you know, I mean, that was really interesting because when I read Bukowski in my 20s, you know, it was a different thing. I liked the irreverence, the debauchery, the drinking, all of the fucking and drinking and throwing up. That stuff, you know. And then revisiting it, when these guys approached me about playing Chinaski, it's like I looked at it differently, you know. The poetry first I'd never read. And I got this vulnerability, you know, and this shyness and that he was really a working class hero in a way. And what I mean by that is not that he was this guy who loved work, but just because he sort of was a voice for all those workers, all those people who would sort of retreat to the bar at the end of the day, working these dead-end jobs, and that fueled his writing. I mean, some of my buddies who work sort of like house painters and stuff, all of
And like you said in one interview also, I mean, he got up in the morning and he was writing every day. I mean, that's the full work itself, and still he also had to go to work, to another kind of work. So he was, that's also working class hero.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, like Henry Miller one time, I mean, he wrote his first book in his late 30s. I mean, he said one day, I remember hearing him say, he said, "I stepped out of the New York Telegraph Company where he was working. He said, I looked down at those masses of people walking down Broadway. He said, I'll never do this again in my life. I'll never be like all these working people running around like ants." And he says, "I am not too proud to beg, and I'll beg if I have to. I'll steal, but I will never work again." And Bukowski's like, he was the opposite, man, in his own way. He said, "I'll never worry about, you know, having the best job in the world. But I'm going to work just so I can..."
I never beg anyone.
Exactly. Because he had a lot of dignity.
And also the need with, like we established the character, that I was leaning on Linda a little bit, but you knew it before you asked her with the clothes. I mean, that's also an obvious one. And you can hear it from some of the Bukowski disciples. He should be more dirty, down and out. Mm-hmm. But like she said, he was always combing his hair, putting his clothes on the chair when we went to bed, and like that. And that's also, it's kind of, it's not sticking to the myth maybe, but it's, I wanted to seem that way also.
You know, and that was the best thing.
Yeah, I think so too.
Because for me, it gave me a window into his dignity, you know what I mean? But this guy was neat. He got up, and you added that thing where he's washing his clothes.
Yeah, that I wrote in, actually. It's not from the book.
But, you know, like, where he takes his clothes, like, he only has one, he had his idea that he only has one suit.
Yeah.
Two suits. One he's wearing, yeah, you know, two outfits, and one he's washing.
Yeah.
Right. And just the fact that he was neat and clean, and, you know, it really was like, it was so, it goes so against what, if somebody was to tell you, oh, you're going to be playing an alcoholic, skid row, living in squalor and poverty guy, you would become a bum. You would just go and wear dirty, filthy clothes. And that wasn't the case. So I was going against that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was really nice.
What I got and liked about your performance, I like your performance better than Mickey Rourke's, better than Ben Gazzara's. I haven't seen the two, but what you were talking about, what I liked about it, I think I got the dignity from you. The element of dignity is in everything that I felt you saying, is going for there was a certain loutishness to Mickey Rourke's guy. He was kind of bent over, there was something caricaturish about him.
Mm, yeah, I think so.
You know, he made that choice. He's not a bad actor, I'm just saying.
Yeah, yeah, and because he wrote
it's
it.
It's a different kind of casket.
Yeah, he also wrote it, so.
But I don't think that it was one of those things like the dirt on the t-shirt.
And I like Gazzara too. I just thought that.
But I think some of the people.
I admire the dignity in your guy.
Thank you very much.
And some of the people who read the Bukowski when I was young, then I accept that they like because it's going against everything.
Right.
And then I can buy it. But when you're getting older, some people just stick to that way of taking him in.
Right.
But when you're older, I think all this kind of stuff we did now is more complex and more.
Yep.
I'm not saying truthful, but still it is. And it's more. I mean, to what to say, more complex, and for me it's more connected to reality, and it's easier to connect him then to people who are not living that kind of life, but still.
Have you guys already recorded a voice track for the DVD when it comes out in the end of the year, whenever that'll be? Is that,
you mean the commentary?
Yeah, I meant the commentary.
Have you done commentaries on your other?
No.
Is that standard for people to do that during the PR?
I did on the one film I directed. I did it later on.
I hate it, so I said no all the time.
You know what? I think for me, I would do it. I did one with Gus Van Sant for Drugstore Cowboy, and that was kind of fun because if you're doing it with someone else, it's terrific. And I did it alone, and I didn't like that. But on my own film. But you know, if I were to do it again, what I would suggest is to do the commentary, but allow yourself to be able to stop and talk about something. Because they don't allow it to stop, so it passes you by. And you go, oh, this scene, yeah, we shot this, and then it's on to the next scene.
Yeah,
you don't get to complete your thought, you know?
Yeah.
You don't get to really, you know, meditate on what you just, what the scene is.
But I find it hard to do in a way.
I have to do another.
Feel bad, and I'll come back.
Okay.
What?
Okay.
I'll take that one.
Is this what you're recording?
Yeah.
Okay.
See you soon, Mark.
See you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Nate. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to eat up too much of your interview with Ben.
But. Anyway, I just want to make sure this is still running. Yes, it is. Okay. So you got here what day?
I got here yesterday.
Okay. I hope that this is not a factotum question, but I hope things keep going for you as far as the Oscar nomination.
Oh, thank you very much.
This is a rote question, but I gather that as far as that you were required to look a little older than you are, so I take it you bulked on a little bit, or is that
No, I did, but I didn't do one of these things where I put on 25 pounds for the role.
Yeah.
I just sort of ate what I wanted. I let myself go, and again, like there were certain, you know, clues that I hooked into with the character that really stayed with me through the film.
Right.
And one of the things was what I was told, and I hadn't seen the tombstone myself, but on his tombstone, Bukowski has a grave on his tombstone. Don't try. And that was such a great insight into who he was. And, you know, watching him, there was a kind of effortlessness about him. And the physical, there's a defeatedness to his physicality, you know, as a man. Like, right. The physical world has sort of knocked him down a little bit. Mm-hmm. He's a tough guy. He's got stamina, but he's a little defeated. So that helped. I mean, I did bulk up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was probably 15 or 20 pounds, mm-hmm. than usual. But and it's just also the body language of the guy.
Yeah.
It's interesting, that idea of this guy. There's something very, I don't even want to say like holy about him, but the fact that he was a very unmaterialistic person. It's very admirable. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I almost feel like the guy made a vow of poverty. You know, like, you hear about those nuns that make a vow of poverty. But, like, he did that. He said, I am going to work these shit jobs just to make enough money so I can drink and write these poems and get by and have, you know, belly full of food. And that's it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's not ambitious, but he's very ambitious as a writer. But, you know, about getting rich,
right,
is not important to him.
I love that line, don't try. I mean, that's a that's something that you could actually tell a person who aspires to anything creative. Because if you're trying to push it out, it's not going to happen. You got to just feel it, be it, let it come. That's what he's saying.
Exactly. It doesn't mean don't do it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean don't do the work, because he did that.
Right.
You know.
Of course, that's the only thing that a person who's already accomplished and gotten to that zen spot can say, I tried as a writer, and I pushed it, and I wasn't that good. But only when I got to the point of figuring out my voice and stuff, so I know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
But everybody tries when they first. Were you trying?
Yeah.
Quote, unquote, when you were doing Over the Edge and way back when? When did you feel that you attained your zen space as a, you knew what you were really doing?
You know what, the thing that I felt freed me as an actor was I surrendered to the fact that I have to be prepared as an actor always, that I can't rely on, because I studied my very early education in acting was all, you know, Lee Strasberg, the method. I worked with Stanislavski based, you know, teachers. Mm-hmm. And it can be very confusing, especially when you're a young actor. There's a lot of stuff that's very internal, and you can have a tendency to cerebralize. I don't want to say intellectualize, but turn things into a cerebral exercise. You know, sense memory is just that. It's your senses memorizing things. It's not your mind, you know, but you get caught up in all that. And, you know, you want it to be organic and spontaneous, so don't rehearse. And it's a bunch of BS, that part of it. You know, you have to be prepared, especially in film, because you don't have the luxury of rehearsal like you do when you're doing a play. You have 3-4 months to rehearse it every day. You're finding it as you go along. In film, you got one shot. So preparation, like, you know, and Bruce Dern said that to me once when I worked with him. He said, you know, you're going to be able to show up on the set some days unprepared, and you're going to do a phenomenal job. But you can't bank on it. Because some days it's not going to work for you. So I think when it became easier for me was when I realized that I need to be more disciplined. You know,
which was at what point?
You know, I think in my late teens, you know, I got a little more disciplined about my life. You know, a little bit. I might say my late teens. It was right around then, early 20s. You know, I was always really good about, like, you know, getting into the character, finding a walk or a voice or this kind of stuff, or what kind of hat he wears, or does he wear shoes too tight and all that shit. But actually, you know, working with people like Gene Hackman, I learned that.
It's funny when I hear someone say that they started to refine, get themselves together creatively in their late teens.
when most of the people that I know, the younger, including my sons, they're not. They might get there in their mid-20s, more like late-20s.
I'm going to make a confession on that last one, because it really was in my mid to late-20s that I really got. Okay. But I think the seed was planted then, but you're right. It did happen.
Yeah. Really
in my mid to late-20s.
Two more minutes.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm in a strange spot, but I got to actually go to a Staples and try and find a charger for my new Motorola.
Moron.
They don't have any places. Everything's about tourism. Everything's about bars and restaurants. There is no place to go in and buy chargers or anything. You have to go out to Kimball Junction.
But down here, they get more Motorola than Motorola tent. They don't give you that?
They
probably don't even have that stuff. Certainly not.
Yeah.
They have all the big gadgets.
Yeah.
Well, listen.
So I got enough for a good
beer. Nice to talk to you, you know.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it. It's nice to